Good morning, everyone.
Please shut off your mobile telephones.
Did everybody hear what Don said?
Please shut off your mobile telephones if you haven't already.
We're reading in Book 9, the Book of Eternal Night. In Canto 2, The Journey in Eternal Night. And we've reached page 593. And I think we stopped at line 403. Death is speaking to Savitri, and he tells her that I, Death, am the one refuge of thy soul.
What number did you say?
593 is what I said. You are.
Oh, the sign here, but maybe I'm wrong. 389.
No,
599.
Okay, sure. I have line 389 on page 592.
Okay. I only am eternal and endure. Okay, let's go on from there. That's page 592. Three lines from the bottom, two lines from the bottom. We'll begin with the line, I am the shapeless, formidable vast. This is Death speaking. So shall we start over this side for a change? Would you like to begin? Yes.
I am the shapeless, formidable vast. I am the emptiness that men call space. I am a timeless nothingness carrying all. I am the illimitable, the mute alone. I, Death, am he. There is no other though. All from my depths are born. They live by death. All to my depths return and are no more. I have made a world by my inconscient force. My force is nature that creates and slays the hearts that hold the limbs that long to live. I have made man her instrument and slave. His body I made my banquet, his life my food. Man has no other help but only death. He comes to me at his end for rest and peace. I, Death, am the one refuge of thy soul.
Thank you. I think that we do not find these words very convincing because of what Sri Aurobindo and the mother have told us and our souls have responded to and are convinced by their message. But if we look at the world as a whole, the world in general, there are many, many, many people who believe this. They wouldn't put it in these terms, they wouldn't use this vocabulary. But there is a widely accepted feeling that we have come from nothingness and we will go to nothingness. So he expresses that. He says, I'm the only thing that is eternal and endured, this shapelessness of space, this shapeless, formless, vast. This emptiness, this timeless nothingness, illimitable. That's the only thing that really exists. He takes his name for it. I, Death, am he. So he is the force of dissolution, of entropy. Everything's running down. Everything that we know, this whole material universe, has somehow emerged out of this nothingness. And we live by this continual process of the eater eating, being eaten. everything returns to that and becomes nothing. And some people even look forward to it. They think that this will bring peace at last. He says, I've made a world, this world that you see by my inconscient force, this material energy without consciousness. Almost all scientific people believe this. It's the default worldview. My force is nature that creates and slays and destroys. It creates these human hearts that hope, these bodies that want to go on living. So he says, I, death, this force of nothingness, this inconscient force, I have made human beings like you as the instruments and slaves of nature. But I just eat you all up eventually. I eat up your life force. I eat up your material elements. And I'm the only help. Yes, please take it. That human beings have. Man has no other help but only death. He comes to me at his end for rest and peace. I, death, am the one refuge of your soul that is struggling and laboring and suffering in the material world. You will only have peace when you come to me. Is your hand up?
Well, I don't know if it's a question or not. You use the word entropy, and entropy is one of the largely inexplicable laws of physics, in that whatever starts with high energy or reaches high energy must sink down and become brittle energy. This is what he's kind of saying. But there's also the fact there that the fact that there is life, that there is the universe, that there is anything, which seems to contradict entropy, and science doesn't know or understand it. Why the Big Bang? Nobody knows how, when, why, and where that was started, etc. Matter may not be, may be neither created nor destroyed. It just is there, always there. Entropy doesn't seem to affect that. And to me, it's a mystery. I'm not trying to explain anything. But the idea of entropy is something he is playing with. It seems that death is playing with that idea, in a sense trying to fool solitude. He's not telling her the truth.
Yes, we are already agreed that he's telling one kind of truth, what seems to be a reality, what is a widely accepted view of reality.
But he's also falsifying the facts. He's saying, I am he, I am the God.
Yeah, I'm the only one.
Giving wrong arguments. I mean, he's false.
Yeah, so
lying, basically. He's coming. He says, I am the God. He's saying that.
So Savitri will tell him that you are one disguise of God. Naturally you are he. We are all he. But you are a disguise, a mask. And you can change also, she tells him. But anyway, now this is the gospel of death. This is what he's trying to convince her.
Here say, and then the one refuse, not the only refuse.
Yes.
The one being the only.
The only one. Yes.
Only.
Yeah. There's no other.
No.
So let's see what he says next, Josie.
The gods to whom man prays can help not man. They are my imaginations and my moods, reflected in him by illusion's power. That which thou seest as thy immortal self, the icon of my infinite, is death in thee, dreaming of eternity. I am the immobile, in which all things move. I am the new inane in which they cease. I have no body and no tongue to speak. I commune not with human eye and ear. Only thy thought gave a figure to my word. Because, O aspirant to divinity, thou callest me to wrestle with my soul.
Thy soul.
I have assumed a face, a form, a voice.
Yes, thank you.
On this first two lines, the gods to whom I'm praised can have not men. The first two lines, the gods to whom I'm praised can have not men. So they are my imaginations and my moods reflected in him by illusion's power. So this, I feel often that get distorted the feeling and understanding towards the gods or the divine which can help, no? And support. Because the human beings and created so many negative associations with the gods together.
Positive and negative.
Huh?
Positive and negative.
Yeah.
It's very often helpful to us to think that there are higher powers who we can turn to for succor and for help. And surely then when we do that, we do get succor and help to a certain extent, no? So this is all part of death's negativity. No? He says even these gods that you pray to, they don't really help. They're actually only things that I have imagined, or they are moods, expressions of myself, no? Reflected in him, in man, by the power of illusion. And then he even tells her that what you think of as your own immortal self is just a shadowy image of my infinite death in the dreaming of eternity. One could really think about these lines. There is something in us which dreams and longs for eternity. And that has, of course, led some seekers, even we could say many seekers, to wish to annul their personal identity, to merge into that vast, peaceful nothingness. No? So he wants to encourage that negative way of looking at things. And he even seems to say that he doesn't really exist. This form in which he appears to her, this voice which speaks to her. I have no body and no tongue to speak. I commune not, I don't communicate with human beings with their physical eyes and ears. Only thy thought, your own thought, has given some kind of a figure to my emptiness. I don't really have this form. You are an aspirant to divinity, and you have called me to wrestle with thy soul. And that's why I have put on this form, this face, this voice. That's very, very interesting what he says. Does death appear to us in the form that we need?
From understanding, can you perceive that all these dialogues of death, he is making to challenge Savitri so that she can come and show her power?
Well, that is my interpretation. That's how I see it, yes. That we've seen her pass through this whole sadhana in the book of yoga. She's had certain wonderful realizations. But in order for things to change on earth, for it to be possible for Satyavan to emerge, the soul of mankind, to emerge from the grip of ignorance and death. Certain things have to change in the setup of the cosmos. And of course, we find it difficult to believe that any human being can change anything in the way the cosmos is set up. These are cosmic laws. How can they change? But Sri Aurobindo seems to be showing us that in fact these cosmic laws are meant to change, and that it's part of the role of human beings to help to bring about that change. But in order to do that, they have to become more than human beings. They have to become more than mental beings. They have to become fully realized spiritual beings. And so Savitri is representing this possibility. There's a letter of Sri Aurobindo's about the poem where he says that all this is supposed to have happened far, far back in the past, at the beginning of human history, when it was necessary to hew the ways of immortality, to open up this possibility for human beings, for mental beings, to achieve the immortal state, the consciousness of immortality. Something like that. So it's all quite difficult to grasp, but we can also see it just as a dramatic way of exposing the contradictions within ourselves, the things that we believe and the things that we don't believe, which are there standing side by side inside us, quite unresolved. No? We listen to Savitri, we are convinced by her. We listen to Death and we find some of the things he says quite convincing. So how is all this going to be resolved?
Recently I read something which was an extraordinarily interesting observation. Amongst all of nature, animal side of nature, we are the only ones who give life to that which truly doesn't exist. What is India? What is it? You got it in your hand? What is this corporation? Something INC. You have it in your hand, we do something with it, we give money to it, we do this and so on and so forth there. We establish reality. Sometimes we make great mistakes and proceed on.
So even the mind can do this.
Yes, and the mind. What is the mind? The mind. The mind itself is just that.
Yeah. So if you have to start thinking like that, then you're ready to read Sri Aurobindo. He will explain to you what is the mind, no? That out of, let us say, this dense, this matter which has emerged from the what seems to be the beginning of the universe, these possibilities are contained, were contained, must have been contained from the very beginning. I maybe in the Life Divine class I mentioned, I've seen recently a film by quite a well-known young scientist, physicist, Dr. Brian Cox, who was influenced by the earlier physicist Schrödinger, who has written a book called What is Life? And on the basis of Schrödinger's ideas, he beautifully, convincingly, in the course of an hour of TV, showed that the fact that we are all alive here today proves that that potentiality for life must have been involved at the very beginning, in the conditions of the Big Bang. And people have also noticed that consciousness must have been involved. That's the anthropic theory, the anthropic principle. that the condition, the initial conditions of this material universe in which we live must have included the possibility and possibly the inevitability that conscious beings like us would emerge. Sosho Bindo says, yes, this is what Vedanta tells us. And it tells us that this is not the end of the process, no? That there are higher possibilities. And that is why he emphasizes on the role of human beings as a transitional species in the evolutionary process. We are supposed to prepare for the emergence of a species that will have a higher consciousness, that will be able to give birth to better things that now seem impossible and even inconceivable. No? He says that that ape, in the primeval ape in the forest, no? How could he possibly imagine what his descendants are going to look like and behave like and the world that they are going to create? In the same way, it's difficult for us to envisage what the future evolution will hold. And that's why the whole idea of evolution is so crucial in his vision. And that's what death is trying to tell now to Savitri. There's no possibility of change. It's all fixed. These are the laws. The laws simply don't allow a dead man to come back to life. It's not possible. So abandon that.
I'm not a Christian, that's true. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's one other great, incredible mystery, even though what you've just described, looking beyond, mm-hmm. beyond, and no one yet knows how all of the atoms, which become molecules, etc., and become various kinds of chemistry, changed from inorganic to organic to life.
Yes, this is the great mystery.
No idea of what is happening.
Actually, they have an extraordinarily good idea, but they can't admit that there's actually a life principle which is somehow independent of matter.
Or they don't have the proof.
They actually have the proof. I saw such an interesting film about biology, and they were describing certain processes and things that happen which are mysterious to biologists, but which are absolutely predictable and obvious if you think that life is a principle in itself emerging and which manifests itself in matter, just as mind is a principle which manifests itself in matter, but it exists independently of matter. But the materialist scientists, they can't allow that to enter their brain, you know. Otherwise they would be in a problem, really. But it would immediately explain all kinds of inexplicable phenomena, such as the movement from inorganic to organic chemistry.
Can you give the reference to that film?
No, I can't tell you, but it's in the video library. It's in French. Some French scientists. Very, very interesting. In the video library. I mean, it must have English subtitles, I suppose. Yeah. Yes?
Regarding what we were talking before this, that man is a transitional being and he will give way to a species which is far more conscious.
Mm.
Almost all traditions and cults and healers are talking about this at present. You have ancient healers who believe that this is a time of transition, so even Buddhas and beings from the other worlds are coming in to help the process. Then you have other people who are saying that in the 60s it was the solar plexus chakra of the earth which was opening up, now it is the heart chakra. So various traditions are actually talking about this, and some kind of a leader gave a very practical example. He said that if you look at children who are being born, now, they are far more, if you see talent shows, they're so talented at such a young age, and they're far more conscious. Things like intuition or sixth sense, if we read Sri Satya Sai Satcharitra, which is about 100 years old, things like, I thought of this in the morning and in the evening somebody presented me a picture. This was a miracle. Now it is an everyday thing with everybody. You think of something and it happens that day, we kind of take it for granted. But it was a miracle to be put down in a book 100 years back. So it is actually visible when we look at our children and the younger kids who are being born.
So this is the hope of the future, isn't it?
Have you ever heard of the indigo child?
Yes, of course. We've all heard of the indigo child, children. Yes. So this is just a confirmation that this evolutionary process is going on. There was even a lady here who has studied the evolutionary change of the skull, and particularly the jaw, and she says in children being born today, this change is going on, which is allowing more space for our brains. But the fact is, we have this brain that we only use a tiny fraction of it already, so far as we know. Perhaps we are using more of it than we are aware of. So, let's get back to the text. So he says that, you have called me to wrestle with your soul. So that is, we don't know how seriously we can take this, but perhaps we can say that there was some kind of need for this confrontation to come about between the yes and the no. So, Amitoj, you are next? No, I'm sorry, I'm going around this way. Kenge, you like to read? But if there were...
But if there were a being with his own, how should he have the passionate desire? Would he watch his soul and absolute indifferent to drive Harry in nameless
calm.
His being is pure,
unwounded,
motionless one. One unrest watches the inconscient
scene.
Where all things flourish, as the calm, the star.
Yeah, we can. Yes, I think we can pause there. Thank you. So then he changes his tune. We see him doing this. No? But if there were, he's claiming to be one being, and then he says he doesn't exist. And now he says, if there were a being witnessing all, how would he be able to help you? No? What is that one? He's aloof at a great distance. He doesn't intervene here. He watches. He's all alone, absolute. He doesn't care about your cry, your prayer. He's always nameless, calm. He's this pure existence, pure, unwounded, motionless one. Of course, these are all epithets which are used in the Upanishad for the one. But then they say, this one has become all this. He's leaving that bit out. He's saying, he's far away. He has nothing to do with us.
For me, comes also in this line that, like children or the mother, the real great being can live, but also can interfere, no? And is connected with the identified
yes.
with the creation.
Yes.
Parts.
So he's insisting on the separation.
Yeah.
One endless watches the unconscious. Unwounded. He's perfect. There's no imperfection. That one lives forever. He is eternal. And in that one, there's no Satyavan, who is a changing human being, and no Savitri. Will you read? Yeah.
The one lives forever. There is no Satyavan.
Okay. One endless.
Sorry?
That's correct.
Where? Line 2425? Yeah.
Sorry. The one lives forever. There is no Satyavan. Changing was born and then no Savitri. Claims from grief, life, a bride of joy. There, love came never with his dreadful eyes of tears. Nor time is there, nor the vain vast of space. It bears no living face, it has no name, no gaze, no heart that throbs. It has no second to aid its being or to share its joy. It is delight immortally alone. If though they desire immortality, be then alone sufficient to thy soul. Living in thyself, forget the man thou lovest. My last grand death shall rescue thee from life. Then shalt thou rise into thy unmoved source.
Thank you. So again, this idea of the eternal one, it's a familiar idea, an appealing, convincing idea, which is at the basis of so much spiritual philosophy and practice. But again, he's twisting it. He's emphasizing one aspect and neglecting the other. He's doing this to try to convince her to forget the man she loves, the soul that she loves, to accept, to be merged back into nothingness. My last grand death shall rescue thee from life. Then shalt thou rise into thy unmoved source. Sri Aurobindo is showing us this because this has been such an appealing call to so many souls, this return to the unmoved source. And it's not that Sri Aurobindo says we shouldn't do it. In fact, he says, definitely, that's the first goal of yoga, is liberation, this becoming free of the illusion of the separate self. But that doesn't mean then that you just vanish out of manifestation. He says, when you have this liberation, that's the moment when you can begin to change something here in the universe. You can make yourself a channel for the eternal will, for the fulfillment of matter. That's the beginning. In some of his writings he says, what a pity it is, what an impoverishment it is, that so many great souls have chosen this way. He contrasts the incredible dynamism and vitality of Indian civilization a couple of thousand years ago with the situation that he was born into at the end of the 19th century. So he wanted to reverse that trend and to open up the possibility that the great souls would return to that dynamic effort to be chariots of the gods, of the cosmic powers, to open up new ways and new possibilities. And that is how Savitri somehow responds to him, not in a philosophical argument, but in another way, a more direct way. Yes?
Shradhavan, I have a question, general question. I read or heard that the greatest harm you can do to a fellow human being is to give a knowledge that he is not deserving.
Or that he's not ready, he's not ready for.
Yeah, it's in the Gita.
He's not ready for
it. And now Sri Aurobindo is giving this knowledge to us.
Because he was sure that the time has come. Yes, absolutely sure.
Yeah, time has come. Because now he says that you are capable, we are capable of even altering the cosmic laws. And people like us who probably believe in Sri Aurobindo and are going to have his faith, and we are going to function in the society differently.
We are going to what?
Function in the society, having this knowledge.
If we would really have this knowledge, really, I mean, not just as a mental notion, but as a knowledge and as a faith and an experience, we would be able to be much more effective members of society than we are at the moment, limited by all our mental preconceptions, not sufficiently illumined by this great knowledge, which is. So you can't function in this society. It will not allow you to function on the idea of some just a mental notion. It won't work.
So we are going to create trouble and disturbances.
Yeah, we can see all the trouble and the disturbances. But the important thing is to get more and more and more illumined, and more people to get more and more illumined, and to have the faith and the courage to act according to whatever level of illumination we have. Mm-hmm. Yes, Don.
Sorry to interrupt again, but what was just said reminds me there is a very famous little legend of the so-called Pandit Bhanti, and that was properly interpreted there. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that, you know, eventually all the monkeys could then understand you have to wash potatoes or whatever it was. It was the next generation that learned. The present generation looked at it strangely and didn't know really what to do. The 100th monkey was the children of the original ones there. Somehow that did catch on there, and that was not a danger anymore. The danger perhaps was with the present generation not really knowing what to do with that knowledge. Therefore getting in trouble. But the next generation somehow, God knows how, could do it. And
you know, an amazing number of people have been deeply attracted by the mother's dream. And at the end she says, this is not going to happen just like that, because humanity is not ready for it. But we are doing our best. That's what we want to happen. And that's what Auroville is created for. So the danger is that we listen to death and we insist on going on doing things because that's the way it's always been done and that's the way it has to be done and there's no other possibility. And that we somehow are convinced in ourselves about our limitations, which makes us fearful, timid, hesitant. We're unclear in our minds. So I think that Ganga Lakshmi published in the news last week, maybe not this week, perhaps the last news, where Sri Aurobindo says all this insistence on action is nonsense unless you have the light by which to act. And Mother comments on that. She says human beings are always experimenting, try this, try that, do it by trial and effort. That's not the way. The way is to find out deep within yourself the true thing to be done, and then to do that. And each one of us has to do it individually. And there are all kinds of influences trying to stop us, like death trying to stop Savitri. So she's not expecting us to... she's expecting us to be quiet and simple and do our work as well as we can and to keep ourselves always open to that higher truth force. That's the advice she gave to Champa Klau, and I think it's good for all of us. Yes, Narendra.
Yeah, I had a random thought now. In the Hindu traditions, we have different gods, Indra and all, for different forces. Are there something similar to the supramental thing we are thinking?
Shobindo says they're on a different level.
Like we will also be in a different level when we attain the supramental status. Like from the physical, we will be rising above the physical and the psychic. And
we,
more powers and more laws in
different ways. We will be finding those parts in us, in our physical bodies, that belong to those higher levels of consciousness. It's not that we'll be shooting up somewhere immaterial.
In this material world, but like the gods, so-called second level.
It's too big a question really to go into now, but Sri Aurobindo says so far, perhaps up to his birth or up to 1920 or something, human evolution has been dominated by the gods, the powers of the overmind. And this is a very, very high level, above mind, but it is still in a way a mind level. It's overmind, but its characteristic is a mental characteristic, the characteristic of division. But this mind, this overmind, he describes it in The Life Divine as a projection, a limitation of the supermind level, which is a truth consciousness which is able to harmonize all contradictions. All the conflicting tendencies and forces which we see warring in the world that we experience are to be harmonized by that power of truth vision and truth power. And that's what we are asked, that is the possibility we are asked to open ourselves up to now. That's what Sri Aurobindo and the mother dedicated their lives to, bringing into contact with the earth atmosphere. And it's here, it's at work. But perhaps we are still living in the overmental creation. But we have the choice. The knowledge has been given, the light has been given. We have the choice. And we can try to follow that path.
Well, that is touched me also, what you just told, how in the Gayatri, old Gayatri mantra, it is a mind. And by Sri Aurobindo's Gayatra is all the levels, he explains it. So that is exactly what we said now. No?
Yes, the traditional Gayatri calls for the light of truth to illumine the mind. And he has changed it slightly. And he says the power of this mantra is to invoke the light of the truth to illumine all the levels of the being, all the levels and parts of the being.
That's what we hear on Wednesday.
That's what we listen to on Wednesday, yes. So how will Savitri reply to him? Chini. But Savitri replied.
But Savitri replied to the dread voice, O death, who witness I witness it not. Reason that scans and breaks, but cannot build, or builds in vain. Because she doubts her work, I am I love, I see, I act, I will. That's answer to her. One depth, one deep surrounding cry. No words of knowing, thou soul cease to love, and cease to will, delivered from thy hurt. The soul though rest forever and be still. Consenting to the impermanence of things.
Thank you. Savitri is insisting on the reality of her own experience. She says, you're reasoning and telling me it must be like this and it must be like that. No? But reason, it's useful. It scans, it looks on the surfaces of things, it breaks things open, but it can't really build things up. If it builds things, it does it in vain, because the mind is always seeing other possibilities and doubting its own works. I'm not acting on that principle of reason. I am like this, I am who I am, I love, I see, I act, I will. And her will is that Savitri, that Satyavan should return to earth. So death is really roused, he says. The cry is one deep surrounding cry. No, also. He's calling her to the highest knowledge. He says, if you know, then you will stop loving. You will stop using your will. You will be delivered from all the impulses of your human heart. And you'll be able to enter the state of nirvana, or peace, or realization. Then you will be completely still and silent and at peace. And you will accept the impermanence of things, that everything here on earth, in the material world, has to die, has to change. So let us read Savitri's reply. Would you read, Tripti? Can you read?
Sorry, I don't have
you don't have your glasses. What a tragedy. Would you read?
But Savitri replied for man to death, when I have loved forever, I shall know. Love in me knows the truth of all changing mass. I know that knowledge is a vast embrace. I know that every being is myself. In every heart is hidden the myriad one. I know the calm, transcendent day of the world, the wheeled inhabitant, the silent lord. I feel his secret act, his intimate fire. I hear the murmur of the cosmic voice. I know my coming was away from, for all his sons were conscient in my birth. Who loves in us came weaned by death. Then was man born among the monster stars. Gowered with the mind and heart to conquer thee.
Thank you. Thank you. Let's pause there. That's what he has, what Savitri has to say. And it's really powerful. Let's look at it closely. This is a much richer kind of knowing than the knowing that causes us to cease to love and cease to will, that puts us into a kind of eternal passivity. Love in me knows the truth that all changings mask. Yes, things change, things are transient, but there's a permanent truth which is expressing itself through all these changings. I know that knowledge, the true knowledge, is a vast embrace. It integrates everything. I know that every being is myself. We are all one. In every heart is hidden the myriad one. He's one, but he's also many. He is all the many. That calm, transcendent that you're speaking about death. He is supporting the world, carrying it. He's living within it, veiled. He is the veiled inhabitant, living within it all. He keeps silent, but he's there. And she says, I can feel him. I feel his secret act, his intimate fire, that fire of energy. And I can hear that murmur of the cosmic voice. I know that the fact that I have come to Earth is like a wave of will and power coming from the Lord to manifest something. All his sons, every one of his many, many different kinds of lights, all of them were conscious in my birth. She must mean her human birth. And one who loves in us, what is this love that we feel? What is it? That's the Lord himself loving in us. He's come into the material world, veiled by death, by entropy, by the need for change and rebirth. So
that word conscience, I can look in line 460.
Yes. Conscient, conscious.
Same.
We're aware, no?
Yes, we're aware, yeah. Fully aware. So the human being, man, was born among all these stars, all this material universe, this vastness. Man was born into this universe, dowered with, endowed with a mind and a heart able to conquer the death, you power of negativity. Man can do it. That's the role of man. She feels absolutely sure of it, because it's based not on reasoning or on teaching or on anything. It's based on the soul's knowledge, her direct experience, which we saw described in Canto 7 of Book 7. So what happens to death when he hears all this? Ellen, will you read?
Sure of his empire in his arm of might, like one who is gaining by the precious world, from which he lifts death answered not again. His feet in silence and in darkness wet, a figure motionless, a shadow veil. Here is the terror of the secret sword, half seen in clouds of fierce assembly face. Night's dust, tiara was his magic hand, the ashes of the fire his forehead sang. Once more a wanderer in the unending night, blindly, blindly forbidden by death vacant eyes, she traveled through the dumb, unseen spot. Around her world the shuddering waste of gloom, its swelling emptiness and joyless death, the center of her thought in light and black. Through the long fading night for the compared, gliding half seen on their unearthly path, phantasmalish in the dreamless night.
The three. So there's actually two things in this passage which Ellen read. One is the description of death and his response. He expresses an eternity of ruthless will, and he's sure of his power. his empire and his armored might. So he does not reply. He just ignores what she has said. Like one disdaining, he pays no attention. He gives no value to these violent, helpless words from victim lips. He's quite sure that he will be able to overcome her. So he doesn't answer. But a change comes over him. He stood in silence and in darkness, wrapped, a figure motionless, a shadow vague. He's got this secret sword with which he slays people. Girt means wearing it on a belt. And this is his strength wrapped around him. No? But half seen in clouds appeared a somber face. Night's dusk tiara was his matted hair, the ashes of the pyre, his forehead's sign. This is Lord Shiva, who is also the destroyer, but he's the destroyer who liberates. Actually, there's a painting, I've put it out today. When we passed through this exhibition with Dr. Premananda Kumar, I said, Shiva, and she said, not Shiva. Shiva's always beneficent. This is Rudra. Rudra is the terrifying aspect of Shiva.
Isn't Shiva also ruthless at times?
Yeah, then we call him Rudra.
You call him?
Rudra. But it does, although he changes, although there's this change in his appearance, otherwise nothing seems to change. Savitri has to move on once more. A wanderer in the unending night, blindly forbidden by dead, vacant eyes, as if there are dead beings around trying to prevent her move forward. She traveled through the dumb, unhoping vasts. All around her is this rolling, shuddering waste of gloom, its emptiness swallowing everything up, joyless death. And that death is resentful. It's opposing her thought, her life, her love. So the three of them continue to move, compelled by her. She's the one whose will is moving them forward through the long fading night, gliding as in dreams, it said at the beginning of Canto 1, gliding half seen on their unearthly path, phantasmal like ghosts in the dimness, moved the three. Satyavan, death, Savitri. So next week we can embark on a new adventure, book 10. Maybe the last three. Five? So many? Okay. It's as far as we can go. It's as loud as we can go.
Temple in my soul, and may the peace explore.
says the fading night. So it's night is coming to an end. The next book is the book of the twilight, and it starts with the morning twilight. Thanks to Shobindo.